Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. It's great to have you on board for this Monday. It's the 3rd of April. Good morning if you're just joining us as well. Where have you been? Don't forget, if you want to catch up on the show, it's podcast on our website, highlandradio.com, from 1 o'clock every single day, broken up into 3 hours, so it's easier for you to navigate. You can also go on to Facebook or YouTube and watch back the show there if you want to. And it's played overnight as well from times, which I don't know because I'm normally asleep or trying to sleep, 1 o'clock and then 2 o'clock on a Friday, I think. By the way, are you like me where, bar the wee trip to Brussels last week for a show, you haven't really been away for a holiday? Do you know where you can relax? You don't set an alarm unless you want to get up and go walking around the place. You don't necessarily have to be cooking and shopping and all that kind of stuff. Well, we have an opportunity for you to avail of plenty of breaks, because our big competition running at the moment is your opportunity to win a holiday of a lifetime with Highland Radio. Or you might choose to do what I would. I would go on maybe 4 or 5 or 6, depending on how luxuriously I want to travel, because you could do so with the €10,000 travel voucher. It's yours if you win, and it sits there, and you could have a number of breaks or one big one. It's completely up to you, however you wish to holiday. It's in association with Atlantic Travel. It's not just the voucher either, by the way, because there's €5,000 in cash. We've already given away a €2,000 prize last week, so we're looking forward to giving away this €15,000 prize in value. €10,000 travel voucher with €5,000 spending money. Now, you can imagine you might want to do the Northern Lights trip. I don't know. You might want to go on a cruise. You might want to go to Lapland, or just maybe hop back and forwards from Lanzarote a number of times. You can do all of that with your €10,000 voucher, your €5,000 spending money. Now, you can win all of that for a tenner. That's the most you'll pay for a ticket. You can go onto our website, highlandradio.com. The competition is coming to an end this week. Wow, okay, right. Oh, so it's this. You've only got a couple of days to enter. I can't believe it's nearly April the 6th already. So if you want to have your name in the Trombola, go onto our website, highlandradio.com, click on Win a Holiday. There's a simple question for you to answer. It's a mechanism we must employ. And you can buy one ticket for €10. Now, if you want to increase the value that you'll receive and buy them for other people, or group in with other people, maybe there's 6 of you in a family and you can get your tickets cheaper. You get one ticket for 10, you get 6 for 50, so that's an extra ticket for €50, or you get an extra 2 tickets for €80. So you get 10 for 80, 6 for 50, 1 for 10. Now, you have to have your tickets purchased by 11 a.m. on Thursday, the 6th of April, this coming Thursday, because the draw will be made live on this show. And the winner will be announced. They'll get €10,000 holiday voucher, €5,000 in spending money. The winner will be announced on this Thursday coming. So if you're going to enter, I suggest you get in quick. Now, the website fully secure, very, very simple. But if you don't shop online, maybe you prefer to give us a call. 07491 25000. We have the team here to take your calls and give you your ticket number. All the ticket numbers go into the Trombola, which is here in studio with me. And then we'll rotate that and pull out the ticket on Thursday. So just, we're getting close to the final reminder time. If you want a chance to win that €10,000 travel voucher, €5,000 spending money, it's a €15,000 prize total, then get your ticket for a tenner at highlandradio.com. As I say, if you want to buy multiples, depending on how much money you have, of course, or group in with others, which is probably what I'd do because I'm tight, 6 for 50 or 10 for 80. So good luck if you're entering. I note when we were away last week that the gentleman who won the €2,000 prizes was up collecting his cheque, and we look forward to next week, or even, well, it would be next week, wouldn't it? Another one of you out there across the Northwest up here collecting your prize, €5,000 cash, €10,000 holiday voucher. In association with Atlantic Travel, 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number, by the way, if you want to comment on the show. Great news about the new service for older people. Yeah, I think, hopefully, I mean, obviously we have to wait and see how it plays out, but I think it's a really good option for, it's not just for older people, by the way. We did sort of pick out that cohort because that was my line of questioning, because I know it can often be most distressful for people in that age groups, but it's not specifically necessarily. Hi, Greg. Very best wishes to John Joe with the new service. Great to hear him on indeed. And the last time John Joe was in studio with us, it was after that awful tragedy in Chrysler. Reflooding. The council needs to enforce some sort of law to enter land if the owners of these lands don't cooperate. There is no point resurfacing the same road and fixing the same piping if the root of the issue is not dealt with. Proper action has to be taken this time. I think we're all agreeing on that, aren't we? Donegal County Council is putting in earth to water systems in houses they own, but it's a very expensive system to operate. Many of the people I've spoken to say doors and windows have not been replaced. The system can only work properly if your house is airtight. What is the point of doing a half a job? Plus, there's no underfloor heating. Again, it can only work right if this is in place. Now, I don't know if that's... I know that's what the listener thinks. I'm not sure how that system works. The Gwibara Conservation Group is holding an information session on Saturday next, the 8th of April, between 4pm and 9pm in St. Bridget's Hall, Letterman Ward. It's to help people with letters of objection to a wind farm planning application on the Gwibara River, which is currently before on Ball Planala. People can drop in any time between those hours. So that's between 4pm and 9pm in St. Bridget's Hall, Letterman Ward. And it's if you are opposed to that planning application on the Gwibara River. Another caller says, so we as taxpayers pay for the inquiry into the hospital flooding, yet our lords and masters decide they will not release the findings we paid for. Why is this? What are our betters hiding from us? I don't know. Next thing you know, they'll be doing extensive inquiries into planning and spending hundreds of thousands, if not millions, on that and not publishing that. What is it with reports and Donegal that we don't get to see? We don't get to see them. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't know the answer to that. We'll try and get to the bottom of it. Of course, that's what we try and do for you here. Right, some comments. Actually, I'll just read this one about the A&E because it's a positive one. I was in the ED on Thursday night with my baby, and I have to say the staff were all fantastic. They never stopped all night. I was there until 5am until I got a cot for my baby in the peds. And even though they were run off their feet, they still had time to keep coming back and checking in on us. They are all heroes. I hope your baby is okay. I'm sure they are, if he or she is, if you're messaging us now. It's this awful, I'm not sure if it's an awful bug, I don't know, but there's a dose going around that's really a clingy one. It doesn't clear up as quick as others do. Our Hudson's had it for now for a few days, and it's so bloody stressful. And I'm sure many of you out there with young ones in the house can relate to what I'm talking about. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's something we have a GP on later on. Maybe we might run past some do's and don'ts in relation to that, because... GPs do their best, I'm sure, of course, but you know yourself, you go to the GP and it could be viral and they send you home and keep an eye on him for 3 or 4 days, and if anything changes, come back, and the temperature's up and down and up and down, and it's really, really tough, isn't it? 086 60 25,000, if you or anyone in your house has been affected by that and how you're coping with it and what have you, just share your views and your experiences. A caller says, I like the idea of pathway in avoiding hospital delays. We need development of such pathways, though. More community nurse specialists and community hubs similar to the rapid response model in Northern Ireland. It needs extending to children too, as they are another cohort that often need care closer to home. Community children's nurses, etc. would be a great development. Excellent to see this going live and other similar initiatives. Yes, indeed. Okay. Now, you're very welcome back to the programme. We welcome onto the show now Dr. Dennis McCauley, who is chair of the GP subcommittee of the Irish Medical Organisation and also a coroner. Thank you for joining us, Dr. McCauley. It's great to have you back on the programme.
Thank you, Greg.
Right. Now, we're talking in the context of you and your colleagues calling for a prescription drug licensed here, classified as a controlled drug, after toxicology reports indicated an increase in poisoning deaths linked to its toxicity. So can you talk to us about the drug and why people might have it in their systems ordinarily?
I think it's a drug called pregabalin, and quite a number of your listeners will probably be on this drug. It's primarily used when somebody has nerve pain, whether it's sciatica or from their neck, that it's actually used. So it's a very effective drug, and if somebody's on it, they're not to worry about it. But it is also a drug that particularly if you have a tendency to to abuse medicines and drugs, it does give a certain euphoria that is appealing to people who would abuse drugs such as benzodiazepines and so forth. So what we found in quite a lot of drug deaths that we have taken to inquest, pregabalin is generally at very high levels. It is, so therefore we feel that we should draw attention to it by asking it to be a Class C drug, which means that a doctor, a GP then can only give a month at a time. There is concerns that people are getting it for bona fide reasons, then other people are getting it and actually selling it. Mm. So it just means that it puts a slight barrier to the GP to remind him that this is an important drug, and therefore it's just drawing attention to doctors that we should be careful of this drug because it is a drug of abuse and it is causing deaths as well.
Can we determine, even anecdotally, Dennis, are the people who are found with high levels of it, would it be the person that it's prescribed for, or would it be someone who's taking it for recreational purposes, if that's the right way to describe it, I wonder?
I think it sort of breaks down into both, really, Greg. Okay. I think there are people who would be there'd be people who would be taken for chronic pain, and maybe their whole issue of the pain is getting on top of them, and unfortunately they may take their own lives. But quite a lot of the time this is a drug that is sold on the street for, I think it is a couple of pounds, a couple of euros, apologies, a tablet. So most of the time, and answer your question, sometimes they are prescribed, but most of the times they're not prescribed.
And as well as that too, you want to ensure that the person who this is prescribed to, particularly if they're vulnerable, that it's they that's taking it, and there's not somebody in the house that's taking their pain relief medicine, and they could then find themselves afraid to raise issues with the authorities. You know what I mean? If people are allowed to have it in large numbers in the homes, you can see how it can create an awful lot of problems.
I think so, and that's why this is the... I think GPs will still be, as it were, they will still use it, but when there's that slight barrier, it makes them think, which is important. And I think that's really why there's the other drugs that we similarly, there's certain sleeping tablets and more sort of codeine or morphine based painkillers that we have to prescribe in a similar way. We have to handwrite the prescription, and it has to be, we can only give, a month's prescription. And so it can't be a 3 months. So the worry would be that there would be a lot of these medicines, if he was in a repeat prescription and they weren't taking them all the time, that they would gather up in the house, and A, there would be a greater chance of them taking an overdose, or B, people could then just be gathering them to actually sell them.
All right. So Lyrica, it's also marketed here. Is that correct?
Yes, Lyrica. It's known as Lyrica. Lyrica is what the name of it is that originally came out, but it has now gone off patent, so it's known as pregabalin. And as I say, I just want to reemphasize, there'll be a lot of your listeners who are on it. Now, they're not to worry about it.
It's not taking it. We're talking about people that have taken too much of it, which applies presumably to many, many drugs that you take as prescribed. And
I think it is that they're abusing it. It has a euphoric answer. Like for instance, paracetamol is used as when somebody takes an overdose, but they're doing it because they want to, to end their lives. There's no benefit from a pharmacology benefit in taking paracetamol. But Lyrica, pregabalin, when there is. People like to take it, that gives them a euphoric effect. And then when that's mixed with alcohol and mixed with other drugs, there can be unintentional deaths from that. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when people are actually try and end their lives, Lyrica is quite commonly there. Okay. And to be honest, have I seen a purely pregabalin death? No, but it's generally a cocktail. Generally, when somebody dies, it's because their brain just goes to sleep and just stops working, and then their heart and their lungs stop. And that's because of the actual cerebral depression. So Lyrica adds to the alcohol, which adds to the codeine, which adds to the sleeping tablet, and that does it. So I think that there'll be no material change. If this decision is made, we're one of the outliers in Europe in that we don't classify this as a Class C Schedule 3 drug. So therefore, when it happens, the only effect that somebody who's actually getting it, you know, routinely for chronic pain, they'll probably have to go and get it monthly from their...
Dr. McCauley, obviously, you know, this is through medical professionals. Like, why would this have to be mandated? Could a directive or a letter or advice not be forwarded to those that prescribe it, asking them to do so only once a month? Or does it, the change of classification, give them a little bit of... a bit of a buffer to tell their patient, I can only give you a month. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it is behavioral therapy in a way. We are, you know, if we're told something, that's one thing. But if we're told that something, but say that you can now do it on a monthly basis, it does affect your prescribing of that drug. Mm. We know that when it goes to a schedule, when you can only do it on a monthly basis, GPs will look for an alternative. Rather so that they can give the patient a 3 or 6 month prescription for that. And I think that is, it's just one of these things that as you say, in a perfect world, you should ring me up and say, Dennis, don't be prescribing that. You have to do it carefully now. And I will then react. But when you do it as a schedule, it actually puts barriers in front of you to prescribe it, which is exactly what we want them to do.
Okay. And I mean, it's a strong voice, the Coroner's Society of Ireland. I mean, you know, will there be resistance to this? Can you imagine? Would people lobby against this? I don't know. Or do you imagine the whomever within the health department is in charge of this go, right, okay, we've had this warning from the CSI here, we better act upon it?
I don't anticipate there'd been any groups who will be against it. Perhaps a few drug dealers would be against it, but I don't.
We're not worry about them too much. Yeah.
I don't think they'll be listening to be actually listened to. So no, I think it is just, it's once again, there's going to be a review of this. We are encouraging it to do it. I would expect it to happen. And as I say, I really think that everybody's just saying, well, most other European countries are doing it. We should do it also.
Just whilst I have you, lots of people I'm bumping into, it was affected, you know, it was in our house as well. Viral condition going around, seemingly amongst young people, I don't know. Is there something in particular that's spreading at the moment, or is this just seasonal stuff and it just happens to be in the circle I'm in?
There still is influenza B floating around. Then there's just seasonal stuff also. I think COVID is there as well. Unfortunately, last September, we had viruses jockeying on top of viruses, and we had strep A, and it was a very difficult time because there were so many viruses at high levels. I think it's a similar picture in relation to the viruses, but there's not as many people getting sick, thankfully, because of the weather. I think I hear through the grapevine that there will unfortunately be, well, I say unfortunately, people are sort of vaccinated out at the present moment, but I think the at-risk people will be encouraged soon to come back for their further booster. I can't actually recall which booster it is. Is it 3? It's 4? Depends if you're over 70 or if you have an actual chronic disease. So there will probably be, the people who are vulnerable will be encouraged to come in once again soon for their spring COVID vaccine. And I must admit that I think everybody is fatigued out, but I do think for this at-risk group that there still is relevance to get the vaccine. So when it is announced, I expect it to be announced quite soon. I would encourage everybody, everybody is sort of viewing COVID as not a dangerous condition now, even people who are vulnerable. But unfortunately, I can assure them that if you are vulnerable, it still is a very serious condition.
Yeah, and just to be clear, because I know people might be taking their phones out, you're speaking specifically about vulnerable groups, that this might lead to a passing blow rather than the full-on hit, because obviously we've got the Irish government's approach to testing and what have you, and also the WHO's intervention more recently as well. But you're speaking specifically, aren't you, in this case, in relation to... And just one other thing while I have you. Last time we spoke to you in January, I believe, we were talking about a project to record suicide numbers. How is that progressing at the moment, Dr. McCauley? Well,
I think it's a very sensible audit. As I say, the countywide figures are not available yet, but as soon as they are, naturally we will be able to have a chat about that in a sensible way. And
okay, well, we'll leave it till then. We'll leave it till then, so it's all in context, and we I appreciate your guidance in that regard. Dr. McCauley, thanks for your time this morning. I greatly morning. Appreciate it. Take care. That is Dr. Dennis McCauley, Chair of the GP Subcommittee of the Irish Medical Organisation. They are calling for that prescription drug, pregabalin. It's also marketed as Lyrica, I beg your pardon. I said it correct the first time. As you heard from the doctor there, often prescribed for the likes of nerve pain, epilepsy, general anxiety disorders as well. But it is being spotted in toxicology reports, a number of poison deaths, an increase in poison deaths linked to its toxicity. And effectively what it would do, it changed the class of the drug and means that it could only be prescribed 1 month at a time. If that's something you've got an insight or an opinion on, 086 60 25,000, your WhatsApps and texts to that number, 086 60 25,000, or again, give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Just got through the post here, a bit of a blurb from on post. Were you watching the Late Late Show on Friday? You would see that. I didn't see it myself. I saw bits and bobs of it. Then I saw some criticism of it, which I don't understand. You know, it's one show of the year that's given over to country music, and then you've got people going, oh, this is the death knell of the Late Late Show, good luck to it, and all that kind of stuff. And I don't see the point. If a particular program of a series is not your thing, just watch something else. I don't watch the Late Late Show much at all. But I do understand that people are going to love the country show, because country music's huge here. But fair play to Daniel O'Donnell, Philomena Begley, Big Tom, Cleona Hagen, and Nathan Carter as well. They're all going to have stamps, which is good, because I don't think that's going to be a big deal in the future, stamps, because people aren't posting letters as much as they did. So I'd say they're getting in there just at the just at the end. All right, 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60. We might try and get Daniel on the program later on, perhaps maybe just to talk about that show. 086 60 25,000, as I say, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000, and emails to comments at highlandradio.com. And just don't forget, you can watch the show by logging on to our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland, or on Facebook. Just search Highland Radio, you'll see us there. Right, we're joined on the programme now, I hope, by Jennifer Carroll, who is the author of Jen's Journey, with the subtitle, How I Changed My Life, Meal by Meal, and You Can Too. Hiya, Jennifer, good morning to you.
Hi, morning, how are you?
It's great to have you on the show. Right, okay, so talk to us a little bit about your, I suppose, relationship with food. Is that an okay way to phrase it, I suppose, through your life?
That's, I suppose, what the book is about, my relationship with food from a very young age. So I kind of go back from the beginning, and I go all the way through until the last couple of years where I've managed to lose a good bit of weight. I started when I think I was a child, it all started through emotional eating. At the time, I wouldn't have understood that's what I was doing. And I think my relationship with food from a very young age was quite a negative relationship, but I just didn't understand that at the time. And that kind of slowly developed into secret eating as I got a little bit older, a bit more self-conscious, and then it eventually became binge eating. And it wasn't until like my mid-late 20s when I was really more aware of that and the bad relationship I developed. And then it was my late 20s when I decided to kind of embark on this journey and try and transform the whole relationship I had with food and my lifestyle.
Yeah, and was it a case that you were conscious of your weight? That did you go through a cycle of, yo-yoing, I suppose people do call it, where you lost some weight, gained some weight, or were you content in your weight until the time that you realised that you wanted something to change?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely yo-yoed. I mean, I didn't yo-yo in an extreme way. I was definitely always in a bigger body. And I think from a young age, I have a 7-year-old son now, and I think I was as young as 8 or 9 when a friend of mine and myself were trying, you know, cabbage soup diets and Atkins diets. And I think it's only now I realize how like unhealthy and how dangerous that was, having a child that age. But from a young age, I think maybe 6 or 7 was when I started to become a little bit more self-conscious, you know, going to swimming with class and in school. And I definitely noticed that I was a little bit bigger, and maybe a couple of comments here and there from people. So I was aware that I was in a bigger body. And that gradually just kind of continued. I got bigger and bigger. And I did, I always tried, but I think the mistake I was making was I put too much pressure on myself. I was trying to go from like zero to 100 and expecting massive results, you know, I suppose at minimum effort.
And was that lonely? Was that a lonely time, Jennifer? Were people around you, even at that young age, aware that this was something you were bothered about? I think, you know, a lot of times when we are really young children and through our teen years, there are things that bother us, but we don't want to necessarily draw attention to them or bother other people around us. And, you know, you spend many long nights sort of on your own thinking about these things. It can be tough. Was that what it was like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I talk a little bit about that in the book, looking back now, how much of my life and time that I wasted worrying about it. You know, like, I don't think there was a night from the age of maybe 10 until my 20s that I didn't think about my size. Like, every night, like you said, I was very lonely. I didn't have any other friends or people around me that were in the same position as me, I suppose. So I didn't really talk about it. And then when if my parents tried to talk about it with me, I was always on the defense and I would just shut it down quickly because I was embarrassed about it. But it was definitely something that consumed my thoughts, like, on a daily basis. Like, and it's sad now when I think of how much time I spent worrying and thinking about it, but it definitely did. Like, it took over my whole, like, that was all I thought about myself was my size. And I thought other people just saw my size over anything else.
Did you feel you had to sort of try and compensate from that? So if you were insecure about your size, that you felt that in other areas of your life or your personality, that you had to almost overcompensate sort of to try and level things out in your own mind?
Absolutely. I mean, I did. I trained in theatre and I was always kind of, you know, the cliche, like the fat funny friend. I was definitely always the loud one. I was a book pleaser because I just wanted people to like me and to see kind of, oh, she's funny or she's nice, not to just see my size. So I kind of go beyond to please other people or to make people laugh. And as much as I hated people noticing me, I always wanted the attention on me as like the funny one, like the clown or the joker. So I definitely think I overcompensated in that way.
Yeah. And how pivotal then into your decision-making progress was becoming a mum?
Yeah, definitely. So my little boy Carter, we were living in the UK at the time and he'd turned one and I kind of realised, okay, you know, it's not just going to affect me anymore. I always held myself back. You know, I didn't go travelling with friends. I didn't go on holidays. I wouldn't go to the beach. I didn't really do a lot of things because I was self-conscious. And then having a one-year-old and knowing, you know, in the next couple of years with swimming lessons, you know, going out and playing, doing sports activities, I wasn't able to do any of that. And I didn't want, like, my lifestyle and size to kind of hold him back and to, you know, stop him and miss out on things.
And what about then, so your own mortality, though, and being around for him? Because I think you mentioned at one point you were 25 stone 8 pounds. Now, I mean, I would imagine that comes with, you know, real potential health risks as well. Did it cross your mind that, you know, will I be here when he's doing his leaving or?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, as well, I'd just become a single parent. So I had that pressure as well, if it's just me and him. And then right before I'd moved home to Ireland and England, I had a bit of a health scare with pancreatitis. And I had to go into hospital for a couple of nights and I had a friend, luckily, that was able to watch him. But I think that was a real eye-opener for me, you know, as in, like, my weight is kind of starting to affect my health. I'd always been relatively healthy. I never had any issues. So I think that never impacted me. But when I had that kind of scare, I was like, you know, I'm really kind of putting myself into an early grave, like eating myself into an early grave was how I felt I was.
Yeah. Now, we're going to talk about the astonishing weight loss. But you come across to me in your story, Jennifer, and I hope this isn't patronising and I don't mean it in any way bad, but an incredibly strong and resilient person. And you directed that, I think, up until such time as you decided to do weight loss, in coping, in being strong for yourself, for your family, you know, dealing with that loneliness that we talked of and putting that brave face out there. Yeah. And it feels a wee bit like to me that you've challenged that amazing inner strength and determination that you had, rather than sort of creating the shield around you, into achieving what you want to achieve in terms of your weight loss.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really nice way of looking. I think when I was bigger and even when I was going through the weight loss, I never, ever would have looked at myself or considered myself as a strong person or resilient. You know, if anything, I kind of felt a little bit weak and like a victim. And I was always, you know, this happens to me and boo-hoo me kind of mentality. But I do think having gone through what I went through, it did make me realize that I am capable, you know, of more. And like, as cliche as it sounds, I think when you've been through a hard life and, you know, not a hard life, a couple of years, it kind of made me realize, you know, if I can take that on, if I can go through that and I'm still here and I still have opportunities, like, I can do this for myself. And it really helped me change my mindset and focus. Like you said, I became a lot more resilient and I just believed in myself a lot more, you know, like, I think when you're wanting to embark on like a weight loss journey, a really, really big weight loss journey, like you said earlier, it's a very lonely place and it can be incredibly overwhelming when you think of the amount of weight you have to lose.
Well, that's what I want
to kind of...
Sorry, I beg your pardon. So I thought you were finished, Jennifer.
No,
the line
right.
is not perfect. Yeah. So hopefully listeners are getting 99% of what we're saying. It's just a slight crackle, but it's fine. We'll stick with it. Now, very rarely I've spoken to someone who is, I think once before, that has lost an extraordinary amount of weight, which I believe it is. You've halved your body size. And in the past, it's only, I think, one or two people I've spoken to that have done it through exercise and diet. And obviously, it's not going to be for everyone. Yeah. And this is no, we're not making any judgment call on anyone that goes through the surgery route. There's been fantastic fantastic outlets for that. But it's remarkable. You've lost 12 stone through diet and exercise through a short period of time. But before we talk to the how, there's a first step. There's a first step, right, to every process. Can you pinpoint when you took the first step, and also like how many times you considered it but didn't take that first step? Or is it grey light? But can you pinpoint in your mind the day it changed?
Yeah, I think this time it was different because, like I said, I was living in the UK and myself and my son were about to move home to Ireland permanently. And I'd been in the UK for 9 years. So for a long time, it was very easy for me to kind of hide my lifestyle and my size. And in the past, I think what I would do is I'd almost set myself up for failure. So I would tell everyone around me, oh, I'm starting a new diet and I'm going to lose 10 stone this year. And then when I'd start maybe hitting a wall or it wasn't going great, I'd give up completely and I'd feel like a failure. And that would kind of lead to that vicious cycle of binge and all that kind of stuff. Whereas this time, I think it was kind of, I was at my lowest point. I was about to move home. I was, you know, 26 stone, unemployed, single mom, coming back to Ireland to live with my parents. And I really felt like an absolute failure. Like I was really low in myself, like no self-esteem. And I think it was just that I decided to do it for myself, but it was definitely for my son. I think it was that moment where I was just like this, like it's now or never, you know, I'm just every year I'm getting bigger. I just have to do it now. And I definitely think he was the driving force that kind of like my wake up call and my reason, and having him as my reason. I don't think I ever loved myself enough to be my own reason or to do it for myself. But I think having him was definitely my wake-up call or my aha moment.
Right. So what is the process then? Because this is obviously in the context of a book called Jen's Journey. And to lose such amount of weight in such an amount of time, did it require massive change? So can you talk to us, and people can get the book and go through it with you, because there's recipes in there. And there's also, I think, a bit of support with why people might eat as well. You know, what is the trigger for you to eat? You talk a bit about that too, and other things that help to change, that help you in your process. So how drastically did your diet change?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't massive. It was the things I suppose you hear people say all the time. I really started to try and introduce 3 meals a day. So I definitely would have been someone, you know, that would skip maybe breakfast and lunch and then binge in the evening. I didn't want to join a gym or do any kind of exercise because I didn't want to put pressure on myself. So I literally just started doing things like cooking my meals. My dinners were all home cooked. Once a week, I would introduce a recipe that I've never tried before just to kind of keep it exciting. And then I think keeping a food journal was something that really worked for me. Every Sunday, I'd kind of set aside 30 minutes in the evening and I would write down my list of meals that I was going to do for myself and plan. I had a 1-year-old, so I was at home with him. So I was able, I had the time.
What a time to choose. What a time to choose this.
So I had like all the time in the world to be cooking and prepping at home, which obviously definitely benefited me.
Yeah.
But I think starting simple, I still was eating like large amounts of food. I wasn't, you know, I didn't cut anything out. That's one thing I did as well. I never said to myself, I'm going to deny myself any food. So I would always have, you know, my chocolate bar in the evening, but instead of having maybe a family-sized chocolate bar, I was just having a Curly Whirly or, you know, a Freddo or just something simple with my cup of tea. And I would never say no if I felt like burgers and chips for dinner, I'd make burgers and chips, but I would just kind of educate myself on maybe how to cook them a little bit healthier and start from scratch. And like really and truly, within the year the 10 stone came off, I always, like, of the whole journey, that was the easiest part. Like changing my mindset and all of that and how I talked to myself, that was harder. But I think people think you have to make massive, massive changes. But just simple things like planning, like organizing a little bit more, maybe writing a shopping list for yourself and cooking with the family. That is something I think was a big deal for me as well. Like introducing Carter into cooking and making it a fun thing, sitting down as a family, eating the meals. And then it wasn't until I was maybe 4 stone down that I decided I wanted to kind of go to the gym. But the gym wasn't for weight loss. The gym was to go for like my headspace. And, you know, I wanted to train a little bit and have an hour a day that I could just escape reality, I suppose. And once I started the gym and started getting a little bit more active, things like my steps, you know, and I didn't start with 10,000 a day or 15,000 a day. I started like going for a 10-minute walk a day, like doing one lap of the estate every evening. And eventually these habits become, you know, easier and part of your routine. And gradually, before you know it, like you're able to do more. And I started to really enjoy all that stuff as well.
Yeah. And do you believe that this is replicable across the board? You know, is there a particular quirk to Jennifer Carroll, like your metabolism or something, whereby, you know, eating the same foods but just smaller portions had a particular impact for you? Has it been shown, or have you had feedback from people that it works for them as well? Do you get where I'm coming from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, I started the Instagram page 5 years ago, and the Instagram page has essentially just been me sharing the recipes. And obviously over throughout the years, speaking to people online and stuff, I've always had really lovely positive messages from people saying, you know, I've started cooking these recipes for the family and like I've seen massive changes and they enjoy the food. That's why it was important for me to keep it simple. But as well, like, obviously it's important to say, I also have an underactive thyroid. So I'm on medication for that. My metabolism is completely different to other people's. But I think everybody is different and different things work for different people. I mean, some people could, you know, intermittent fasting. I could never do that. Some people, the weight loss surgery, that was definitely an option. I, you know, went to look into that when I was in the UK, but it wasn't for me because it was my mindset I needed to change. But I know people that have had it and have had great results. So I do think everyone is different, but I think the whole thing, what my book, the recipes, my book that's important, is they're just simple recipes to cook. I obviously track my calories and protein, so I include that, but they're just kind of recipes that I wanted people to open a cookbook and be like, oh, I have all of that in the house. I don't need to pop to the shops and get this spice or this herb, or I don't have any of that. They're just really simple recipes that I think are delicious. And I've heard people say that they are nice, but I've definitely had feedback over the years from people.
Well, with a really active Instagram,
good results.
Yeah, and with the Instagram page too, you're getting constant live feedback. It's a constant assessment of what people are trying and all that works. So it's tried and tested already. So when you lose that amount of weight over a year, does a lot come off quickly? And then it sort of plateaus, and then you have to adjust your mind so as you don't lose heart and you keep going, or because there's bound to be a couple of stone there that can be, that may not even be body fat, that can be rid of quite quickly. So there's a bit of, you have to control your, you know, how you're thinking about it and expectations and all that type of stuff, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer. So I lost weight over 2 years. The first year I lost 10 stone and the second year I lost 2 stone. And the second year I was just focusing a little bit more on like training, and that was when I started tracking protein and calories. So in the second year I only lost 2 stone, but my shape was really starting to change and I could see that a lot more. I think the first year when I lost the 10 stone, that was quite a dramatic weight loss. But obviously, I was left with quite a lot of excess skin as well. So that was something where I'd always say to my trainer, like, oh, in the last 3 years, I've been working on like maintaining my weight. And every now and then I might be like, oh, I'd like to lose a couple of kilos here and there, or say over like a Christmas period, if I gain some weight, I'll be focusing on losing. But like you said, it is important. Like everyone's body is different. I would have quite a lot of muscle now. I'm always going to have, you know, excess skin in different parts of my body. So I definitely would weigh more. And I think it's important as well for people not to focus on a number. You know, I think especially women, like you compare, and like even my friends, we'd always throw, well, we don't anymore, but we used to always throw around like, oh, I weigh X amount. And then you kind of think, oh, I need to weigh that. Whereas be like, oh, I'm like quite fit, I'm healthy, I feel good, but I'm like 4 stone heavier than my friend, and I don't think we look that different. So I definitely think it's important not to focus on the numbers.
Yeah, for sure. And I really am uncomfortable with that whole process on some TV shows of getting people to stand up on scales. And
exactly.
It's horrendous.
Yeah, I don't agree with any of that,
Right, okay. Listen, it's a remarkable journey, but it's achievable. You're just like everyone else. You know, there's people out there listening that, that can do what Jen did. If people want to get hold of your book, Jen's Journey, do you suggest they go to your Instagram in the first instance or the bookstore? So tell us, in your own words, tell how people can get hold of the book and follow you.
So my Instagram is Jen's_journey_IE. And I do have a link in my, on my Instagram page to buy the book online, but it's also available in all bookstores. So any kind of good bookstore will have the book at the moment.
And presumably because of the way in which you've done this, it's sustainable or more sustainable in that really, you know, you're eating a lot of the stuff that you enjoy. And that's the one slight issue I think that some people get a bit of a gonk with the operations, is that it can actually change your eating habits into the long term. and some people struggle with that. And that's fine. But right. OK. Listen, it's been lovely speaking to you. Best wishes to all the family and congratulations on the book and everything else you've achieved. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Bye bye. Jennifer Carroll there, author of Jen's Journey, How I Changed My Life, Meal by Meal. And you can too. Apologies for the slight crackling on the line there. Hopefully, I'm sure most of you got the message there. Right. OK, let's get to some comments here. Good morning, Greg. Would you please wish Noreen Gallagher in Downing's a very happy 80th birthday today. This comes from all her friends in the Carrigart Choir. We miss her and hope to have her back with us again in the choir very soon. Have a great day, Noreen. A very happy 80th birthday to you, Noreen. Your choir colleagues looking for your return ASAP as soon as you are able to. Have a happy birthday. And by the way, we're always open to wish people happy birthdays, anniversary or whatever. By the way, more than happy to do so. You are very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Some of your comments here. I've been on this drug for 7 years because of a waiting list for hip surgery. I've been reading about this for years and my consultant said there would be no problem with it. I'm prescribed 600 milligrams daily and it's now caused diverticulitis disease in me. This means my 50-year-old bowel is now an 80-year-old bowel. I can't wait until the day I can get off these drugs along with several others. You only get this medication in your monthly prescription. Yes, there's people who use this for recreational purposes, but this is such a dangerous drug, says that listener. Okay, listen, thank you so much for giving us that insight. Hi, Greg. I don't think it's very fair if the GEA start turning their clubs into asylum centres. What are our young boys and girls going to do then? They need the clubs for their own mental health, socially and fitness. Is that on the cards? That was flagged last year. And the GEA said no. And I didn't realise the government had come back to them on that. I mean, whatever about disused areas or what have you. I mean, the GEA clubs are incredibly important. And I'm sure that would be greatly resisted. Donegal County Council are filling the same potholes every second week in the same place, and fillings get washed away once it rains. I wonder, is it dry weather filling they are using? I don't see that as much as I used to. I mean, there's a lot of areas on main roads that are riddled with potholes, but the repairs seem to be much better now than maybe they were in the past. I'm not quite sure. My mum was sent into the ED last week and sat for almost 24 hours, only to be sent home as they had no beds. Was a line of elderly people sitting in chairs not getting seen. One lady, 90, was taken in by ambulance at 5 p.m. and no doctor had come to check on her at 2:30 a.m. I thought this was terribly sad to see our elderly people just ignored. Imagine working all your life to be left like that. Don't get me wrong, I know they are busy, but there doesn't seem to be a system in the ED department. Now, the one thing I will say about that is that, you know, there are going to be times that an elderly person... And I advocate an awful lot about older people on this program, and I hope people recognise that. But they treat people in terms of the condition of the person. And even if a 90-year-old person is stable in the ED and you get other people with traumas and other emergencies, they probably will be put ahead of the older people. And that's why this pathway hopefully is a way to keeping people out of hospitals and out of those waiting lists. Nurses repeatedly called people that had already gone home, says a caller, but that's because people gave in, didn't they? Didn't they? One lady waiting with a three-year-old for an x-ray was there at 5 p.m. and still no x-ray when I was leaving at 3:30. I don't understand why you have to go to ED for an x-ray, and I really don't understand why you'd have to wait that long when the technicians are there already walking about. Surely that lady could have been with her little one and let go way sooner than that. There's no system in A&E and the needs looked at as a matter of emergency. But again, if that young person is bumped up, someone else is bumped back. That's just the way it is.